Okay, so yesterday I started by describing this kind of simplest possible matrix model, integral over this kind of complexified matrix phi, p string trace w, where w was some polynomial, gk phi to the k, principle at fixed degree, although in some sense it's interesting to work with the class of all of these polynomials. So just to, and we saw that out of this, this in the large n limits, the solution of this matrix model was completely encoded in terms of this algebraic curve y squared equals w prime of x squared, plus f, this polynomial of degree n minus 1, f of x, that was the usual loop equations. And so there were two kinds of moduli. There were the moduli tk, and there were moduli kind of sk. And the s's were given, so sk was given by the period integral of kind of the cycle ak surrounding the branch count of the one form y dx. So just to press this point once more, so if you think about this kind of natural one form that's always in the game, let's call it eta, y dx, this meromorphic one form, one way to distinguish is the s's and the t's is if you differentiate this eta respect to the sk's, then these are given in general by some matrix, so there is some matrix mkl, and then they are expressed in a holomorphic one form. So these are typically, here you get things which x to the l y, where this l is greater or equal than n, I think, or let's see, less than n. So these are different, what you call differentials of the first kind. They are holomorphic at infinity, so dx. And if you differentiate eta respect to the tk's, this will be proportional to a differential which look n plus l over y dx. And these are differentials of the second kind. And these are meromorphic at infinity. So that's really the distinction somehow between these two moduli. And there's a much better understanding of this in terms of Calabi-Yau manifold. So let me now say briefly something about how this structure is naturally coming from a Calabi-Yau. So the kind of Calabi-Yau threefolds picture, that actually is a non-compact, as a non-compact space, is given by, so that's what we will do all the time whenever we have these Riemann surfaces, where we boost them up to Calabi-Yau threefolds, by writing a hypersurface in C4, and the hypersurface will be of the form UV, plus, in general, actually, any function f of xy equals 0. So I'm very much interested in non-compact Calabi-Yau manifolds of this kind. You could, of course, take a more general hypersurface. But actually, for hypersurfaces of this type, there's a nice theorem, I think by Chan and Yao, which tell you that actually these non-compact spaces allow for Ricci flat metrics, which are conical at infinity. So in general, to have that, you have to have some restrictions on the powers of the variables that appear here. But these are kind of very well behaved. So they allow for Ricci flat metrics, which are basically constant flat at infinity. And whenever you have such a Calabi-Yau, there's an obvious holomorphic three-form. And the holomorphic three-form is du, dx, dy, can be written in many ways, of course. But the nice way to write this is like this. This is the kind of holomorphic three-form that lives on this Calabi-Yau x. Now, whenever you have such a Calabi-Yau three-fold, essentially, so it's nice to have the following picture in mind. So here is the xy plane, the holomorphic xy plane. And you think of the Calabi-Yau as being fibered over the xy plane. So the fiber, the typical fiber, is some kind of a curve, which looks like uv plus f is 0. So as long as f is non-zero, this is a smooth curve. So it's a rational curve. I could draw it as a Riemann surface like this. It has a preferred kind of cycle. And then whenever the function f becomes 0, so in here is the locus where f of xy is 0. So this is your plane curve. This is the plane. This is the algebraic equation that defines the curve. And over this locus, this curve becomes singular. That is, this neck shrinks to 0. So One thing you can immediately see, if you take your holomorphic tree form and you kind of compute the residue by integrating along the fiber, what you get is a two-form, dx wedge dy, on this plane. So from this setup, that's not true for general Calabi-Yau threefold, but for threefolds of this type, you can kind of reduce them kind of to a two-dimensional picture, complex two-dimensional picture. And then there is a natural two-form, which is just a standard kind of symplectic form. So a picture I very much want to kind of advocate is that this plane should be thought as a phase space. So the variables x and y are kind of canonically conjugated. I also will try to kind of think of this f of xy as some kind of a Hamiltonian. And so the curve will be kind of the level set. Using a fancy word, would be the Fermi level. And so at some point, we are certainly tempted to write down kind of canonical commutation relations and lift them to quantum mechanical commutation relations. So this equation, I want to kind of keep you in mind, where G string is H bar, and that's already kind of clear from this point of view here, right? So, and all these things, you really should think of G string as H bar and N somehow as the quantum number of the system. Now, in fact, what you can do a little bit more, if you want to compute an honest period around some three cycle of omega, you can do it in two steps. You first make this reduction over here, so you can write this as the integral dx dy. And now, of course, in order to have a three cycle, you have to take some kind of a real slice. So now I want to think of this picture in real coordinates, and f, say, as a real function. And then you see, actually, that if you integrate the holomorphic three-form around this cycle, it only makes sense if, say, kind of, f is positive. So you get an integral over dx dy over the region where f is positive. So in some sense, in this picture, the cycle will be, we kind of think of filling in this blob inside the curve. So we have this region of phase space that's filled. And then by Stokes' theorem, we can also write this, of course, as a contour on the curve of the one form y dx. And so this is the way I want you to think about this one form that we naturally got out. So I should have said here, we got the curve together with this one form eta y dx. And you see the y dx descending somehow from the Calabi-Yau. But through this intermediate step, which essentially is the setup of classical mechanics. What is? Why? How do you see that there? Okay, I'll actually come to that in a moment. It's just a very good point. Yes. Right, so I want you to think about the large n limit, which is the limit n to infinity, say h bar to 0, h bar n fixed, as kind of the classical limit. Right? This is a large quantum numbers, and these, so h bar times n would be kind of the usual, kind of the definition of the energy, say, yes. So this setup actually, so let me say one, we come back to this, but I want to also say something about the all genus answer. So if you want to solve the matrix model for all genus, the loop equations, so these loop equations still work for all genus. And so what you do is you look at the matrix model, and you look at diffeomorphisms. So you look at diffeomorphisms where you change phi in some polynomial way, so n greater or equal to minus 1. And so you mean that you have a vector field, so let's call it Ln, which is phi n plus 1 dd phi. So these are matrix redefinitions of your matrix integral. Obviously, this group works. And it's kind of the half of the Virasoro algebra. And then you can derive word identities for that integral. So usual way, this is done as follows. You look at the integral d phi, dd phi I j, and then you put here phi j I to the n plus 1, e to the 1 over g string w. Just working this out, the dd phi can act either on this power here Or here, if it acts on the product of matrices, it kind of splits the product in terms of two traces. So you get two terms here. So the expectation value either of trace phi to the p trace phi to the n minus p, sum over p. And the second term, where it acts on w, where you get 1 over g string trace phi to the n plus 1 dw. And this expression can be written as a differential operator, Ln, acting on the partition function g equals 0, where Ln is now written, so that's the famous Virasoro constraint. You write this as g string squared. So you recognize that to get two traces downstairs is the same thing if you start with the path integral, or the matrix integral, twice differentiating respect to the t's. So here you get the sum d squared dt p a dt n minus p. And then there's a linear term, which is the sum ktk dd tn plus k. So this is, here you view the action of this diffeomorphism in terms of the second order differential operator, but it's a much nicer way to write this, basically using field theory. So let me remind you that an important ingredient was the resolvent of the matrix. So this function y of x was defined as follows. It had two parts. It has the derivative of the potential. And then there was like a quantum correction that we could think of as obtaining by integrating out the angular variables. So this was the Coulomb potential between the eigenvalues, which was given by the resolvent. So if you use this resolvent language, then you can write it slightly different. So then the loop equations become integral d phi. It's the same identity, dd phi ij. And then you write here 1 over x minus phi ji e to the 1 over g string w. So it's the same identity. And if you work this out, you get the standard form of the loop equations, which is the trace of 1 over x minus phi squared. So this is the expectation value of the square of the resolvent plus 1 over g string trace w prime of phi x minus phi. So this is 0. And there's a very nice way to write of this directly in terms of conformal field theory notation. So I will do that because that's one point of view I want to generalize to other contexts, for instance, the C equals 1 string. So what I want to do is remind you that this function y had an interpretation as computing the derivative. So y of x. Remember, it was what was this? It was essentially the force on a probe eigenvalue at, say, lambda, eigenvalue lambda at x. In fact, we indeed could write as dx of phi, where phi is the action, so phi of x is the action of an eigenvalue, and you can just write it using that formula as w of x. So this is just the classical potential in which it's moving. And then the quantum correction, which is 2g string trace of log x minus phi. So this is just the Coulomb potential of x with all the other eigenvalues phi. And now it's interesting to write this in terms of differential operators. For instance, you can this y dx phi, you can write it directly in terms of the t's, and you can see that this is sum k tk x to the k minus 1. It's just the derivative of w. And then there's a term 2g string d dtk x minus k minus 1. So I want to think about these two things. So here, the tk's, so I want to kind of you should view is that you have this problem with this corresponding Riemann surface. You're tuning the tk's, that is, you're changing the value of y at infinity. So these are kind of the coupling constants. And they are, in some sense, in kind of ADS CFT language, they're unnormalizable. They grow at large x. dtk, of course, is nothing but the one-point function of trace phi to the k. So, and these are, so these terms are the one-point functions, and they are kind of the reactions of the system on tuning on, changing the value at infinity. So these are, in some sense, the response of the system, or of this matrix model, to turning on the coupling constants. So if you use these languages, this language, this picture, then there's a very cute interpretation of the loop equations, because now you can write down the stress tensor, T of x, for that field, phi, really seen now as a quantum field. And of course, this has a mode expansion, which is precisely are these operators Ln I introduced before. So one way to write the loop equations is to write this equation, this algebraic equation, y squared. Now, think of this as a quantum expectation value of t of x. And notice that we want this still to be an algebraic variation. So as a function of x, I want this to be algebraic. So what does that mean? That this is some polynomial in x. So in particular, I want that the negative powers of x in t of x are 0. And this is equivalent to the loop equation, because this is precisely the loop equation, this identity here, are precisely the negative powers in x. So this is equivalent to putting this condition ln is 0 for n greater than minus 1. So the way I think about this as follows, you start with this function y of x, you start to perturb it. In general, it has lots of positive and negative powers. But then you want that the perturbation in the as the shape of the Riemann surface remains kind of this. So in some sense, this perturbation should be well behaved at small values of x. So y squared, so this, we have this curve somehow. We're chasing it at infinity for x large, but we want it to be kind of smooth inside. And being smooth inside means that this is polynomial in x. And that's how you read these loop equations. So one other remark, last remark, also something we make use of. I introduced this field phi, which was the effect of action of a single eigenvalue at position x. So it also makes sense to write e to the phi, actually plus or minus phi. So this I will call psi of x. And e to the minus phi you can also introduce, which is psi dagger of x. So what is this? Well, this is actually the thing that you insert in the path integral if you put an eigenvalue at x. So this is actually, if you look at it, it's e to the w times the determinant of x minus phi. Yes? Yeah, so at this point, it's a quantum field. Yes. Yes. And so I should have put in here brackets, right? The loop equation is something about the expectation value of y. This is reading the loop equations, interpreting the loop equations. Yeah, so it's very important that this has self-contractions, because that makes the loop equations nonlinear. So the higher genus loop equations are, and so one way to put is the loop equations are differential operators, differential relations. And they become algebraic in the planar limit. So they become algebraic because you can write this as at large n by using factorization. Yes. Precisely. I want to make it an operator, yes. 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 Precisely.
And so we can relax, but if we don't use these kinds of methods,
yes,
we can borrow.
Yeah, so just to mention one thing, I will actually do that better, but if you do these double scaling limits, so then the curve, so that means, for instance, the simplest one would be to have the Gaussian model, which has a branch cut like this with two branch points. Now, the double scaling limit, you're just sending this one branch point to infinity, making the curve y squared equals x. Now can you repeat all of this here? And you get beautifully like the Virasoro constraints that we found in the for pure gravity.
Yeah,
Okay, so that's somehow the same picture. It's living on this curve, yes. Yes, yes. So, but the important thing here I want to say is that... Sorry? Yes, oh, it's very important, yes. There's a G string, I guess, well, perhaps 2G string, yes. And so I also want to put another thought in your head, is that think of this as a wave function. Then this phi is like the kind of WKB action of the wave function. So somehow the planar limit is like a WKB approximation to a wave function. So that's perhaps a slightly different way to think of bosonization. I want to think of the bosons as building these wave functions, these coherent states essentially, and the fermions are the wave functions that correspond to that. So, and the final picture I want to put in, and we actually come back to that later, that if we have our Riemann surface, so here I have my picture of my Riemann surface, and now in this Calabi-Yau manifold, so recall that this is embedded in this kind of Calabi-Yau manifold, I can now put brains, which are non-compact, in kind of the U or V direction. These were these kind of orthogonal direction. And I can put this brain at a position X. And this is a system to study and try to explain better. But so my statement is that whenever you put a brain on this, so we have now this geometry, you can put brains on it, non-compact brains. That means brains which do not have dynamical gauge fields. They're like flavor gauge fields. Then this brain putting at position X, this will correspond precisely to this operator psi of X. I mean, that's somehow the picture I also want to kind of put here. So any questions about this part? Because I want to leave it now for a moment. So there are in the topological string, there are topological B brains, which are points on the Riemann surface and have one complex direction pointing off. One, yes. Precisely. They're transversal D5 brains, yes. And in terms of the gate theory, which I now will turn to, these are just putting fundamentals in the gate theory. Any other questions? Okay, so now I want to kind of change direction completely and say something about the gate theory interpretation, and particularly the map of these matrix models to the gate theories. And then, I guess on Thursday, I'll return to this picture and describe more complicated geometries which correspond to more complicated matrix models, or sometimes they do not have a straightforward matrix model interpretation. So our aim will be to extend to, to kind of C equals one string in these minimal models. And perhaps, but that's a little bit ambitious, to general Calabi-Yau of this type. In particular, coming from mirror symmetry. I mean, why do you get this particular Calabi-Yau?
Yeah, there's some other places where this is a natural set of Calabi-Yau.
Well, of course, these were studied before we had matrix models, right? So it was somehow. So they naturally appear from. So one place where they naturally appear is from mirrors. One thing, there are very places where they naturally appear. So they appear as closed string duals to, for instance, brains wrapped around three manifolds, right? So there's the story about basically doing Chern-Simons. They are natural, the things, the closed string duals to Chern-Simons theory. That's where they appear. They very naturally appear from various kind of mirror symmetry constructions. And basically, the manifolds that have an extra symmetry, the symmetry in this UV direction. Right? So in all the lots of toric constructions, they appear. Whenever you have a manifold which has a T2 vibration, the mirror will have this structure. So it's a big class to study. But of course, there are there are other Calabi-Yaus which are not of this type, which also have matrix model duals. Okay, so this will be somehow the aim. So let's now change gear completely and say something about n equals 1 gate theories. And so I start by saying some trivial thing, but since the audience is quite varied, let me first say a few words just about, so we're down to four dimensions again, n equals 1, d equals 4, super Young Mills. And let's start with the simplest case, which is pure gate theory. So we have a simple gauge group G. So what does that mean? So it means that you have a, come for the mathematicians here, you have a connection A mu, and then you have spinner variables associated to it. So you have so-called gauge nodes, lambda alpha, lambda bar, alpha dot. Everything is the adjoint representation of G. And you write down an action for it, and the standard action, I already wrote it down in superfield notation yesterday, but it's a standard Young-Mills action, so 1 over g squared trace f wedge star f plus then the Dirac operator for the lambdas, d slash lambda. And then you can add a topological term, the theta over 8 pi squared trace f wedge f. So the important thing of this theory first is that it has an obvious symmetry, that's the U1R symmetry, which rotates the lambdas. So we can send lambda alpha to e to the I phi lambda alpha, lambda bar alpha dot to minus e to the I phi lambda alpha dot. And this symmetry, which is a classical symmetry of the system, is broken by instanton effect. So it's a famous anomaly, U1 anomaly. Of the U1R. And the anomaly is given by an appropriate Chern class. So there's some current that's not conserved, but the anomaly is 1 over 32 pi squared. And then it's the trace in the adjoint, so it's just the index theorem, but applied to fermions, which are the adjoint representation. So the Chern class that you compute here is the trace of FHF in the adjoint. So in particular, if you compute this, say, on some four-manifold or in some instanton background, this topological number, it will be n times h, where n is an integer, and h is the dual Coxeter number, which is the value of the second Casimir in the adjoint representation. So in particular, this is n minus 1 for, what I'm saying here? No, it's n for un. Or sun. So what does that mean? That means that if you compute the index of the Dirac operator, this will be quantized, and it will be quantized in units of 2 times h. So that means that fermion numbers are only conserved modulo 2h, and the usual way to state that is that there is a possibility, if you have a correlation function of 2h of these gauge nodes, that this thing is non-zero, and in fact, whatever it is, it will be proportional to e to the 2 pi I tau, where tau is this complexified gauge coupling, theta over 2 pi plus I 4 pi over g squared. And if you wish, by the usual kind of dimensional transmutation, I can also write this as lambda to the 3h, where lambda is the dynamical scale. So that's the standard picture. And then the statement is that this breaks, of course, the phase rotations. Yes? Sorry? Yeah, so I should have put in here, of course, yes. So there's a scale here, lambda 0 to the 3h, where lambda 0 is the cutoff scale. So the lambdas have canonical dimension 3 halves. So So the important point is now the following. You have this U1R symmetry. It gets broken by instantons to a Z, a cyclic group of order 2H. And this is to be believed an exact symmetry of the system, but not one which is realized as an unbroken symmetry. So it's spontaneously broken, and it's spontaneously broken by a famous effect which is called Gugino condensation. Namely, it's broken to a Z2. There's an obvious Z2 symmetry which just flips the sign of lambda, and that's the same as making a 2π rotation, so that's something that's impossible to break because it's connected to continuous transformation. But the rest of the symmetry is broken, and the usual statement, this is broken because there will be an expectation value to a bilinear of the fermions, and it's nice to take it in the usual way, so lambda alpha, lambda beta, epsilon alpha beta. And using the notation I had of yesterday, this is the same thing as the lowest component of this field that I called S, this glue ball superfield. So the statement is that this will have some non-zero expectation value. And one thing you can easily check, so we have this, but we have another effect, which is that if you take the expectation value of S to the H, going back here, you find that this is can be computed exactly as an instanton effect. So this is lambda to the 3H. And for those of you who are familiar with quantum cohomology, this is a statement very similar to the quantum cohomology ring of CPN. In fact, it's not coincidence that it's related, because if you take the four-dimensional gate theory reduce on a two torus, you actually get the CPN model. So this is like the quantum cohomology ring of the gate theory. This is the quantum chiral ring. And now you can think of states that kind of diagonalize this ring. And these states are states, vacuum states, so I should give them some label k, where the expectation of value is non-zero, and then by definition there should be some phase, e to the 2 pi ik over h times this lambda to the cube. So the lambda to the cube is there just for dimensional reason. So these are very mysterious things. They're called fractional instantons, because somehow the instanton charge, if this would be an instanton effect, because this would be proportional to e to the 2 pi I tau over h. So it's somehow an effect of 1 over h, an instanton of 1 over h. So it means that one of these beautiful quantum field theory effects, which are not captured semi-classically, it's not an indexed computation. It's also not at all clear that in R4 there are non-perturbative configurations in the path integral that kind of dominate this expression. It's really a nice quantum effect, but it somehow follows quite directly from somehow, say, cluster decomposition together. So cluster decomposition is just a statement that this expectation value is the 8th power of a one-point function combined with this one instanton effect. Now, so this is a very deep dynamical effect, and while there are experts in the room, I'm not quite sure what the precise status is of this effect. I think to a large extent this is conjectured behavior. Any rigorous proof of this would be wonderful. But in some sense, this is very strongly, so this one of the remarkable things I feel is that this effect, this strong coupling dynamics, is intimately connected with the story I've been telling, essentially also this kind of Calabi-Yau manifolds. And so the reason this connection goes is the following. So there is a beautiful, the Gabriele and Shimon Yankelevich wrote down a beautiful effective action that captures this effect. So there's an effective action that you write for S seen as an order parameter. So you write some function W of S, which should have the properties that its minima, so dW is effective to zero, gives you these values for S. And there's a unique possibility. Namely, one thing you know, that this action will start off with the usual Yang-Mills action. So it will start off by an action 2 pi I tau times S. So it's linear in S. But then you use the fact that there is the anomaly. That is, if you rotate S, so if you rotate S over 2 pi rotation, which is rotating the fermions, then you, by definition, the anomaly will tell you that, well, this is an anomalous transformation. So what you have to do is you have to, in some sense, simultaneously rotate your theta parameter or this tau parameter to tau plus h. That should be invariant under the combination. So this actually fixes the term. So the term here should be non-single valued in terms of s. And actually, just by dimensional arguing, you find that it's given by this term, s over lambda 0 cubed. So this is the famous VUI effect of action. And if you somehow are able to derive this exactly doing the path integral, you're done, because this will describe the dynamics. So I'm not quite sure what now precise status of the thing is. So morally, it's obtained by integrating out all the gauge fluctuations. It looks very much one loopy, but it's I still want to kind of call it non-perturbative, because it really captures all this non-perturbative information. At least from my point of view, it's a non-perturbative object. So the question is not so much to derive this object as to see, as I put it, the problem yesterday, given a certain general gate theory, how does this answer changes if you couple matter? And so there's a very well-defined prescription to this. And so what we will actually do is connect these answers, in particular also this formula over there, directly to the geometry of the Calabi-Yau manifold. And to the, we will take the route through the matrix model. So the general problem we want to solve is the following. So we have some gauge theory, gauge group G. We have matter in some representation phi. And we start with some interaction for this matter. So what we have an action that's a d4x. And then there are two kinds of terms. So there will be so-called d terms, which are integrals over the four theta variables, which are, in some sense, don't really matter to us. But we take an easy choice, and we make them quadratic, which means that we write this expression. So this is the field phi. This is the conjugate field phi bar. And I'm assuming here some G-invariant pairing to write down this action. And V is the gauge field. And then there are self-interactions of the phi field, which are given by the superpotential, which is this W of phi. And then there's the complex conjugate term. Let me also write it. Integral over theta bar of W bar of phi bar. So this is a class of four-dimensional field theories that we want to study. And this, of course, plus the Yang-Mills action. But the moment I just want to think of this as a quantum field theory of the matter fields, coupled to a background gauge field, if you wish, V. In fact, we always will use this field strength, W alpha, that I defined yesterday, which is E bar squared. So the question is, can you compute exactly using this quantum field theory? And so remarkably, the answer is yes, you can. No, this is in general G invariant polynomial. So W. Yeah, so an important issue is this, that these W's, this could be a non-renormalizable field theory. And the general philosophy is the following. Well, we are computing F terms only, so we're computing the infrared behavior of the theory. So you are free to put a cutoff there. And then you will find, in the end, that the cutoff will not enter in your computations. Actually, you'll see this very concretely, because whatever you are computing will be perfectly finite. So it will certainly be independent of the cutoff. So the statement is, in this class of field theory for general W, computing F terms, so the F terms, I mean, to first approximation, the F terms are kind of insensitive to the ultraviolet completion. So in some sense, perhaps you want to think of these W of phi as itself being an effective action of integrating out various fields in a properly well-defined field theory. So, but I actually often will use a very simple, so if you wish, you can just start with the W, which is quadratic. So we have W phi squared plus some, say, cubic thing. I mean, that's perfect if you have a quadratic and a cubic coupling. Now, the way in which this you manage to do this is to recall that we're going to compute an F term, so whatever you're going to compute will only depend on the holomorphic coupling constants. So what we're going to compute will only depend on the coupling constants that appear in W, not in W bar. So this will be independent of W bar. So strictly speaking, W bar is the complex conjugate of W. But since we're only interested in some sense the chiral fields, we should think of this perhaps better as a holomorphic conformal field theory, something like that. It's a chiral path integral that we're doing. And in the end, we get a chiral answer. So if you be very bold, you can just put W bar to zero altogether. But that actually makes this integral here kind of very ill-defined. Sometimes get the delta function for phi. I'll comment on that in a moment. So it's better not to put W bar altogether to zero, but you can make a nice choice, namely you can make it quadratic. So I'll make the choice that W bar is quadratic. And also want to expand one ordinary quantum field theory where I expand around the trivial vacuum component. So in principle, of course, you would have to minimize W of phi. You get the story that I gave yesterday, many critical points. I will say something about it later, but at the moment I just want to expand around the trivial configurations. And so now how do you do this quantum field theory? Well, it's actually quite easy. Since now W bar is quadratic, you have a Gaussian integral in phi bar that you can do by hand. So you find actually, you can substitute. So you find, you have to do a few manipulations. One of the manipulations that you have to do is to write actually, in order to do the Gaussian integral, to write phi bar and phi all as integrals over 2 thetas and 2 theta bars. So it's in our paper. I won't go through the whole song and dance, but in the final answer is the following. You can integrate out phi bar and get an action only in phi, which is holomorphic, so d4x, d2 theta. And then the action that you get is the following. So there are some simplifications along the rule, but it's along the road, but it's 1 over 2 m bar. Phi, and then here comes a term, the Laplacian, minus I W alpha, where W alpha is this Lie algebra valued super kind of field strength. So this thing here, so it's an element, so it's in the Lie algebra. And if you look at it in its canonical dimension, it's like weight 3/2 field. So in the end, what you get is this term here, plus W of phi. Where this term over here looks strange, it's this is the effect you got from just doing the Gaussian integral, right? Here we have a quadratic piece, here we have m bar phi bar squared. So you expect to get something with 1 over m bar. And it multiplies a funny field, because this is a Laplacian, so this is second order derivative respect to the axis. This is a first order derivative respect to a spinner coordinate. So it's a little bit strange, but remember this has weight 3/2. So this combination of a Laplacian and this, which looks like some kind of fermionic Dirac operator, kind of makes sense. Also notice that the phi is a bosonic field. This is a linear operator, so that also looks suspect. But it's a linear operator respect to an anti-commuting coordinate. So that's why you can write the first order derivative respect to theta. Whether this thing is a square or something? Yeah, so strictly square, you can write it as d bar, where these are the covariant spinner derivatives. Yes. Yes. Yeah, right. So in some sense, yeah, you're quite right. There is some redefinition here. No. So what you do is you can either, you have always this freedom either to take phi or phi bar easy, not both. It's not conjugation. It's something which, because in some sense, because of this term here, you can never redefine it away. But you can take either your field phi or phi bar simple. And in this approach, of course, you take phi simple. So that's why, in some sense, the only way in which, so there are in some sense no covariant derivatives, there's only coupling to the field strength, but that's because we redefined our field phi. That means that phi bar is a complicated expression, but doesn't appear in the path integral. Sure?
Usually I think of M bar as a background anti-chiral superfield.
Yes.
It's a little strange to have an F term which depends on.
Yes. So it should not depend on M bar.
Right.
Yeah. So, of course, so there are two points of view. Well, there are two remarks to be made. So first, yeah, so why was there any anti-holomorphic dependence in a holomorphic object? Well, so first of all, you immediately notice that it's completely trivial dependence, because if you just rescale x and theta, you get rid of it. So if you just rescale x to square root of m bar x, theta to m bar theta, and then remind yourself that d theta times theta is kind of 1, so that means that this transformation rule leaves the superspace measure, the chiral superspace measure, that's important, invariant. Looks kind of funny, but this means that d theta transforms with the inverse power of theta. And then you see easily that you get rid of m bar altogether. So it's kind of easy, well, you can put it to 1. Another question is, well, why not put it to 0? That's another good choice. Actually, if you do that, you see that you get a constraint. If you put m bar to 0, you get a constraint which looks something like box minus I w alpha d alpha on phi 0. And morally, this looks like the path integral is kind of localizing. In the sense that w would be 0, this would be Laplacian on phi 0. Think of working on a compact four-manifold. It would mean that phi is constant. Basically, it's harmonic. So this is some kind of super harmonic condition. But I think there's actually a big problem with this. For instance, if you look at, so if you put this field at x, and you put another field, say phi at y here, and you take the limit, x going to y, actually this expression is very well known, and so I'll come back to that when I hope to say something about anomalies. But this is, can be written, writing phi again in terms of phi bar, this is phi bar e to the v phi. And this is a famous term, because this is a so-called anomaly of the Konishi current. So this is something which is in some, this is delta function, say, of x minus y times this trace w squared. So that already noticed, so it shows you that it's kind of fine to put this condition to 0 for a single one-point function. But if you, for instance, have a two-point function in the path integral, there will be an anomaly that says that you cannot really put these fields to 0, this to impose this constraint, if you have coinciding fields. So actually, if you want to kind of localize the constant fields, everything is kind of coinciding. So this seems, I think this is an anomaly that prevents you from kind of taking this naive localization picture. So it's better to put it to 1. Then you got rid of m bar, but you, of course, have a complicated path integral to do. Yes. Well, it's exactly. Yeah. So, you do indeed this kind of thing where you integrate dz bar, and that's kind of dangerous.
Okay, yeah.
Yes. Yes. What am I doing here? No. Well, I'm just integrated out phi. So, if you wish, I take I will at certain point compute certain quantities that you know will not depend on the coefficients of w bar. Right. So I will just.
Well, I don't see the changing that the plane w bar has different coefficients that violate the entirety.
Yes.
But I mean, that seems a little bit different.
Yes.
From
I know, but so I'm not making any statements, kind of non-perturbative statements. It will be all about Feynman diagrams here. So I think then actually these objections are not very dangerous. Anything I will say, you can do with the phi bar path integral.
Yeah, but there should be something
about finite dimensional. Right. That's the analog of this. Now, I think it's our matrix model. This, in some sense, I'm claiming this path integral reduces to the matrix model. So the way in this matrix model was defined using this contour is just the reflection of this four-dimensional path integral.
Okay.
It's the same issues. But I think already of a chiral boson in two dimensions. I think that's a good analog. So then I would compute something like I would compute the full path integral, and would recognize it be a product of a holomorphic times an anti-holomorphic piece.
Right.
And that's what I will do here. Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so it's a bad analogy. A free chiral boson. Okay, I appreciate your point, but I don't think actually at doing these Feynman diagrams, we run into it. So how do you treat this path integral? Well, you do this using first, so here you kind of inspired by string theory, to kind of do not second quantize, but do it in the first quantize language. So we will have Feynman diagrams like this. And we want to think of these Feynman diagrams in some sense as kind of alpha prime to zero limits of open strings. So what we want to do is we want to work in so-called Schwinger parameters. So we always want to think of these Feynman diagrams as kind of singular one-dimensional manifolds with a metric. So the SIs, which are the Schwinger parameters, they're kind of the length of the propagator. And then whenever we have a propagator of length S, and we'll have some momentum flowing through it, so we have bosonic momentum P mu, which is just ddx mu, and fermionic momentum P alpha, pi alpha, which is dd theta alpha. Whenever that thing is propagating, then we have a Schwinger parameterization of that, which is the exponent of S minus S times the Hamiltonian. And you read off the Hamiltonian from the quadratic part. So I should say, of course, here there's an m phi squared plus interactions. So there's a quadratic part, a holomorphic quadratic part, and an anti-holomorphic part. So this will just give you p squared plus pi alpha w alpha. And then there is an m here. So you can think of this as an Hamiltonian acting in a, if you wish, on wave functions, which are L2 functions on this chiral superspace, R4/2. They depend on four axes and two thetas. And it's a funny operator because it's a quadratic usual Laplacian, and then there's this linear operator in the odd variables, but it's multiplied with this Lie algebra value W. And so if you have a Feynman diagram like this, you will have integrals about the following. So what we generally have, you have a product over all edges, DSI, and then you have product over the momenta, the loop, the momenta P and pi, but you parameterize them. So they're, of course, not independent. They're given by the, well, this momentum conservation. But another way to say that there are loop momenta, that is, the, in general, you write the PIs as linear sums of variables pi a hat, where this variable a runs from 1 to L, where L is the number of loops in the diagram. And similar, of course, for the fermionic guy. So this is a 4-vector. This is a 2-spinner. Delta I pi a hat. And that's the usual parameterization in terms of the loop momenta of a Feynman diagram. So for instance, if you have a diagram like this, you will have momentum p1 hat flowing through here, p2 hat flowing here, and momentum minus p1 hat minus p2 hat flowing through the third leg. So you have a product over all edges, then you have a product over the loops, from A from 1 to L, the integral over the four momentum P hat A and the four over the fermionic loop momenta pi's of this whole thing. So the exponent, say SI times PI squared plus W alpha P alpha I plus M. And the whole thing gets multiplied by a group factor, which is a symmetry factor of the diagram, and of course the various coefficients that parameterize the vertices of the field. So these are the usual Schwinger parameterization of your Feynman diagram. So this is a completely standard thing to do. And let me just say one point of view. So we know how to do this in string theory. In string theory, we have a Riemann surface of a certain shape, say it has moduli, and then what we do is keep the shapes fixed and then kind of integrate out the conformal field theory, so we get some kind of quantity that only depends on the moduli. So here, similar, there's some kind of a moduli space, which is kind of a moduli space of Feynman diagrams, which are parameterized by these Schwinger parameters, S1 up to SL. And we want to get a quantity that only depends on these parameters. So what we want to do is first integrate about the momentum P and pi, and then integrate over the S's. So this is kind of standard to do. So you can first integrate the integrals over the P's. What you then get is a very simple expression. You notice that the whole thing can be written as a Gaussian. So PA hat, MAB, PB hat, where MAB is like the period matrix of the diagram, but you can think of it as a Riemann surface, right? So if you think of it as an open Riemann surface like this, it will have a period matrix as it has in string theory. It's like the imaginary part of the period matrix. It's this L by L matrix. So doing this integral, so I should give the definition here. So the period matrix is determined in terms of these matrices L. So MAB is sum over ESI LIB. And so doing this Gaussian integral gives you a 1 over the determinant of M, in general to the power d over 2, where d is the number of space-time dimensions, which in our case is 4. But it's important perhaps to keep it for general D, because then you can see some phenomena possibly happening in other dimensions. So that's the bosonic integral, and then you want to do the fermionic integral. And then there are a few remarks to be made. So the first remark is to make that whenever you integrate over pi, this is a fermionic integral. So the standard rule we will do is that if you integrate anything of the form E W pi, that this is just W, because it's an odd variable. So for every integral over pi, we get down a factor of W. So the fermionic integral, whatever it will do, it will give a factor W to the 2L. And also, I argued yesterday that the only thing that can appear is trace W squared to the power L. So this will be always a form S to the power L. So that you somehow get automatic. Another remark is that if you look at this basis of loop momenta, so we can always choose it cleverly. So if you give me a Feynman diagram like this, think of the momentum flowing through one of these variables, like called pi 1 hat, and take that to be the momentum through this particular edge. So if you do that, that means that the only dependence on pi 1 is, so the dependence on pi 1 is very simple. And that means that, so these W's, they can be inserted anywhere. But since pi 1 has only two components, a two-component spinner, there are only two possible components of W getting contracted here. So by choosing this basis, you see that you get at most two W's per edge. That's also an observation you get for free. But then the question is, of course, how does the group theory work? On certain diagrams, you can do quite easily, quite general. So for instance, a nice, simplest possible diagram is the one-loop diagram. If you do this diagram, it's L equals 1. So there are two W's. So the only thing that you have to do is two insertions of W. And in this case, you have to do the integral ds over s. That's the natural measure for the circle. Then you get the 1 over s squared from the bosons. That is the determinant of m squared. And upstairs, by just expanding the exponential, you get s squared trace w squared. So this is an integral you can do. This is actually, you have this is something which will cut off dependent. Sorry, and then there's still e to the minus sm, because that part of the propagator is still there. So you can do this integral. Well, you have to introduce a cutoff, but after you do that, you find that this is trace w squared times the logarithm of m over the cutoff. So this is a good example of one of these diagrams. In this case, you see that there's an integral over the bosons, which gives a dangerous behavior downstairs. This could be singular for s small, but this is compensating factor of s squared upstairs. And so the diagram, this is a diagram that it's finite up to this logarithmic dependence.
M or m squared?
It's m. So it's m here because m bar is 1. Right? So it's m bar in some sense. But we choose the gauge where m bar was put equal to 1. So that's why there's not an m squared here, which you... Sorry? Yes, m is a complex number. This is a holomorphic term. So it's the holomorphic contribution to the... Well, you have this plus the complex contribution, if you wish. All right, so we're computing a term in the superpotential. So I'm saying that this is a term in the effective superpotential, which is, well, if you compute it, it's a C2 of the representation that's running around times, because you have to take the trace in that representation, times S, times logging.
You're allowing S to be a
component. No, S is by definition just this quantity. No, this is just an ordinary Feynman diagram. Yeah, so it's from infinity to whatever minus the cutoff or something.
So m should have a positive real part.
Oh, in order this to make sense. Yes. 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 Good point. Well, we should learn more functional analysis. That was your. I definitely should. Just complexify. Okay, so a few remarks. So there's a general story here, but just to finish and make the punchlines, let's not do the most general case, but take this example where G is UN, and phi is in the adjoint. And let's indeed take the simplest case where W is a cubic potential, so like this. And then you should look again at this interaction that we wrote down for the coupling to the gauge field. So the coupling to the gauge field was in the following form. It was phi. And now we remember that it's an adjoint valued, so the connection works in through commutators. So it's W alpha commutator with the... So this is the coupling of the gauge field to the matter field. And if you now draw a Feynman diagram, so draw the phis, which are n by n matrices as double lines, you see that this W either kind of attached to one line with a plus one, or it attaches to the other side with a minus one. But it always attaches to the end of the line because it's in the adjoint representation. So now you can draw your Feynman diagrams, and now there are a few observations. So suppose we have some diagram. We use the double line notation. So suppose we have a loop which has no W insertions, then we get a trace of 1, which is by definition n. If you have 1 W insertion, then there's an index running around, which is not freely summed over, because in some sense this is, well, the index here and here is the same, that this gives you WII. So this gives you trace of W alpha, which is the U1 part, the U1 inside the UN. It's the abelian gauge field that's left over. And then if you have 2 of these W's, WW, you have an index I here, an index J here, and so you're computing WIJ, say alpha, WJI beta. Well, they better be different, so you contract it with an epsilon symbol, and this is the thing that we have been calling trace W squared, and this is our field S. So S corresponds with 2 insertions on a hole. The U1 gauge field is 1 insertion on a hole, and a factor of n is no insertions on a hole. And then there's the following combinatorics. So the combinatorics is the following. Take your favorite diagram, draw it as a string diagram. So it has holes like this. It might have handles. So H is the number of holes. G is the genus. And so this is one of these gate theory kind of double line diagrams written as a string surface. And the number of loops, L, is the Euler number, essentially, minus 1. So this is given by 2g plus h minus 1. So it's the number of quantum loops. So just to check these formulas, if you take your standard diagram, so for instance, this is the planar form of the two-loop diagram, so that is a sphere with 3 holes. So this has h equals 3, g equals 0. And if you take the non-planar version, the same diagram, which is a torus with 1 hole that has h equals 1, g equals 1. So now there is the following fact that whatever we are computing, we knowing that we are computing a term which looks like w to the 2l. And we also know that we either have 0, 1, or 2 w's for each hole. So you get an easy statement. So definitely the number of holes better be bigger than the number of loops, because certainly we need to get rid of 2L of these W's. And pulling that back in to this equation, we find, of course, from that equation that H is L plus 1 minus 2G. So immediately from there, you find that G better be 0. So the diagram is planar. So I'm always kind of confused how easy you derive here planarity. And I strongly feel that this is an argument that should be applied in other quantum field theories. But in some sense, it only depended on kind of counting fermion zero modes. So it's a different way in which you get planarity. It has nothing to do with large n. It just has to do with the fact that there is this kind of, correspondence between the number of fermions in the system and the number of bosons, essentially. It's really so supersymmetry here gives kind of planarity. And in fact, you can easily see there are 2 possible solutions to that equation. So one equation, so because you need that H is bigger than L, greater than equal, but actually for G and 0, of course, H is L plus 1. So you have 1 hole to spare. And so there are 2 possibilities. So either you have, so let me just indicate this for the diagram like this, and let me use some color. Yes.
Are you saying that there's only planar diagrams?
Yes. 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 Well, for these computations.
Only for these F terms.
So it's only F terms, of course. If you wish, not, well, if you wish only, I'm computing the part in the effect of action that depends on the chiral superfield W. There are also things that depend on W and W bar. There are other things to compute. For instance, this is the simplest F term, which is the coupling to the gauge field. You can also couple to the metric, have a similar story there, and there you will get the higher genus things. So there is a way to get the higher genus diagrams out too. But here only the planar diagrams appear. And you see there are two possible solutions. Namely, we have one more hole than we need for getting rid of all the W's. So one thing possible to do is to put two W's on each hole. Then you have one hole left. So what do you get? Well, this one hole here has no insertion, so that gives you a factor of n. And then there's a choice, because you have to pick two of the three holes here. So in general, there's you have to pick one of the possible holes to not insert anything. And then you get an S to the L. So another way to write this immediately is that this will be, so this, and you get a sum of these things. So this will, you see immediately, this becomes something like N, the derivative of a function with respect to S. Where F is the thing, so it has some expansion. Okay. Sure. I agree. So that's a powerful argument. So we have factorization in the chiral ring. So you say it's large N. There are some things that I wouldn't sound very convincing if I end my lecture here. But so first remark is that. Well, so of course we not only, so there's a second punchline. Not only get planar. It's planarity, but yes. One thing so people have. Try to push it a little bit further. For instance, the fact that if you do compute a gravitational correction, you get genus 1. It's more difficult to argue, to have this argument, what the full 1 over n expansion, how it enters. Also, of course, it's not clear from that point of view, unless you start to do the actual diagrams, that it will be not only planar diagrams, but planar diagrams of this kind of zero-dimensional theory. Right? That certainly depends on supersymmetry.
Well, except that there's no special function.
On the one-point functions. Yes, but again, if you would trust that argument, I would ask you to kind of show that the whole path integral reduces directly in the path integral to kind of a zero-dimensional theory. So, for instance, one fact which I find, for instance, which I can actually immediately show. Oh, in retrospect, these are convincing extra arguments why such a thing has to work. But it's still good to go through. I don't think actually. Well, one thing I find very interesting from that point of view, that this factorization works for any group and any representation. And so it seems very much independent of the fact that you have a classical group where you can take a large n limit. Which begs the question, what is... Yes. I could have taken E8, so I won't be have time to say now and think about it. So there's a very nice paper by Akinagi's interrogator of Warner, who actually investigate the E8 case. So you can actually try to do these diagrams for a general gauge group. And you get something... Partly, there is some conjectures that go in. But for instance, one thing you know that whatever you get will be an analytic expansion in the diagram. So that's not a way to think, to argue for planarity. You know, whatever you're computing, it better converge, has some nice analytic property. So if it cannot be the sum of all Feynman diagrams, so that's another argument why planar diagrams are nice. But then, of course, for E8, well, you get some answer, but what are the diagrams? So you get some truncations. So in general, I think in general what you can show is that the path integral reduces essentially to a zero-dimensional integral, over the field phi, now considered as a kind of matrix, just it's a representation of some group. But then if you just naively would do that integral, you get the wrong answer, because that would be actually the sum over all diagrams. So there is some mechanism which changes the rules of the weights of the individual diagrams, which for classical groups corresponds to the weight where only the planar diagrams contribute. But there's an analog story for EA. So there is some class of new weights for EA diagrams, which make the series converge and give some analytic expression.
By the way, is it known that that dividing up of EA diagrams, if we go away from that term?
Yes. That's a good point, because I think the tricks they did are sort of using, essentially go to the diagonal one, which, so you're asking whether the full E8? Yes. I don't know. So just to finish the story here, and then I'm done, so you see one important point, that if you compute, say, suppose you had only had interested in functions of S, not of the U1 gauge field, you see that you have one loop which is not used. So there is this interesting relation that the correlation functions in the gauge theory are not the correlation functions kind of in the matrix model, but they're derivatives respect to S. In fact, it's interesting to point out that this gives a direct connection between also variables. So for instance, if you compute some correlation function, trace phi to the k, in the gauge theory, well, you have some diagram with some vertex, which will sit in some big diagram. And then you have to dress every loop with all of these insertions. But you always miss one. So this thing actually will be something like, in general, n DDS of the same quantity you can compute in the matrix model. And the direction goes the other way around. Suppose you're not computing trace phi to the k, but trace phi to the k w squared in the gauge theory. So what do you now have? You not have this diagram, but you have two extra insertions of w. So they're already sitting here. So that means that the two that you were missing were already provided. So now just everything gets inserted. And so this will be just directly the trace of phi to the k in the matrix model. Sorry? To the non-planar graphs.
No, the ones where there's just one.
Yes, yes, yeah, I will return to that. Yeah. So this is first an interesting statement, that whenever you do the translations between the gauge theory and the matrix model, you have to use this dictionary. So the final remark is that if you take a diagram, so indeed, the other insertion is where you take, say, two, you put two at every loop, but you now pick out, select two important loops which only have one. So what is this? Well, this will have no factors of n. It will have a factor l plus 1 choose 2, because you have to pick two preferred holes. It gets a factor of s to the l minus 1. And then it gets a trace w alpha for one factor and trace w alpha for the other factor. So what this is actually computing, this is something which you can write in general as some effective coupling, depending on S, for this trace W squared. So this is a U1 gauge field. And you see that using this language, that is tau effective, is the second derivative now of that function. And this generalizes, so I should of course say that this generalizes to the broken vacuum. So there's a story here, I won't give it, to vacua, so spontaneous broken symmetry. So the vacua where we had these multicut solutions with distributions of eigenvalues. And then these functions generalize in the sense that W effective will be the sum of ni, df, dsi. And this tau effective will be a matrix, rj, which is d squared f dsi dsj. And this actually will be the period matrix, of this curve, y squared equals w prime squared. So there's a nice graphical interpretation of the period matrix, because it's computing this kind of coupling constant to this U1 gauge field, and it's a sum of all these diagrams where there are these kind of two preferred loops, which in this case is this green one and this green one, while computing the effective action is computing the first derivative of the sum over the diagrams. So the final thing that you don't have to do, though this picks out the planar diagrams, there's still an integral to be done here, namely you have to integrate over the bosonic and the fermionic variables. But I'll be very short about that, so if you just you can prove it's quite general, that in the end, the integral, all the factors of S cancel, and only in D equals 4, it's very important, this story would hold in any dimension in some sense, but in D equals 4, there's a very nice cancellation between the numerator and denominator that appear, and the only thing that you're left with is this very simple propagator, which was M. So the M, then the Feynman rules are extremely simple. For every propagator, you get a, for every edge, you get a propagator 1 over M. Say for every vertex, in general vertex of order K, you get a coefficient TK. And you compute for every loop, you get a factor of S. So which means that this looks like H bar N, say, in the large N matrix model. So in that sense, you establish, at least in perturbation theory, the correspondence with the matrix Feynman diagram. So you see a remarkable reduction of a four-dimensional gate theory to a zero-dimensional path integral. And this works in general. If you would have not started with a four-dimensional gate theory, but the four plus k-dimensional gate theory, you would, along these lines, would have ended up with a k-dimensional system. So in some sense, you can get rid of here of four of the space-time dimensions by using this this correspondence. Well, any questions about this point? Yes.
Usually, these graphical tricks, after people think about it for a while, they figure out a functional way of deriving.
Right.
Has anybody succeeded in
no
way of understanding
its
localization
in
zero dimensions?
No, and as I said, I think there's this anomaly. I wanted to do this.
Yeah.
So I think, okay, perhaps this anomaly is a good way to... So I feel somehow taking the anomaly. I mean, there is the thing, of course, which this work of Cacciozzo et al. Relating directly to the anomaly, which in some sense is the path integral
right.
to these loop equations. But I think they never really, in some sense, you know that it's computation of anomaly in four dimensions. So you know in some sense that can be reduced to, well, to just the measure.
Not, I mean, can't you say by now that it's not a reduction in the path?
Well, it's, in some sense it is, and in another sense it isn't, because the important thing is, of course, that it's not just your field phi that appears in the matrix model. It's not this field phi. Because this could be a 2x2 matrix. And the field phi in the... So what you use, in some sense, you have to use this trick to write... You start with a path integral of a 2x2 matrix, which is depends on superspace coordinates, and then only pick out its planar diagrams. So... Yes, there have been some attempts to do this in some kind of non-commutative framework, to kind of Gucci Kawai, and then... I think if you have a good path integral derivation of this, it would be wonderful, because you would be, I think, probably directly in business for general representations. And also, for instance, in the cases where this, these matrix models do not make sense. So I think that's still open, I feel. But it should be there. But I feel somehow you certainly know that part of the ingredient will be dealing with the measure in the right way. Because in some sense, the... And another point I want to mention, perhaps the last point, why this would be extremely interesting. So actually, the matrix integral, I haven't emphasized this, consists of two parts. It consists of a perturbative part, which I reproduced here by using Feynman diagrams. And it's a non-perturbative part, which is this Vy term. Now, the moment you write down the matrix model, it comes with a canonical normalization, because it's a gauged matrix model. So there's really one over the volume of the gauge group. At that moment, or if you wish, the moment you translate it to the geometry, the moment you give it in terms of a Calabi-Yau, The spirit integrals over the Calabi-Yau are just holomorphic functions. They don't know about what the perturbative piece is and the non-perturbative piece. So they're really there together. And the fact that these are as a non-compact Calabi-Yau is really a reflection of this logarithmic behavior. So in some sense, if you were able to kind of derive the matrix integral directly, I think you would also somehow understand this non-perturbative stuff. Because if you somehow were able to derive directly a closed string, a geometrical representation of the theory.
But you'd have to start with
half integral. Yes. Well, yeah, I could have put W to zero and, yes, yes. But okay, in that case, yeah, no, that's a good point, yeah. Yes. 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 Sure. Yeah. So the CPM model is a little bit putting you on the wrong leg, because there the sigma field is really a fundamental field, right? So the point is here always why. Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's. Well. Yes. 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 Right. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Sure. Yes. 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 Precisely. Yes. Well, there certainly have been attempts like that in the literature, and also I think claims even that integrating out the gauge fluctuations gives this S log S piece. But I think if I read closely, always at some point the anomaly is feeding. So I don't know of any really honest one loop computation. Yes. Right. Yes. 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 Yeah, well, I must say I always had a very naive understanding of this term, but people feel very strongly about it. So this sounds perfectly fine with me, but some of your colleagues will object strongly. Okay, thanks.